read Babylon in Jeremiah 50 and 51. This is part 5. I had originally intended to do all this in about 4 sermons. Now I'm not so sure of what it'll be. I know it'll be 6. I'm not so sure of what it might be 8 by the time I finish with these 2 chapters. This is a long passage similar to other long passages in the Scripture, which are, in effect, end-time prophecies. 110 verses here about something called Babylon and its destruction. And the last time we read in Jeremiah 51 of God's power of creation as the creator and the sustainer of all that is or ever was, and yet we read that God will use Israel to destroy this world-destroying power called Babylon here in Jeremiah 50 and 51. We also read in the prophet Obadiah of the destruction of Esau, Edom, and I had shown you from history and from the writings of the Jews themselves that the people we know as Jews today are the descendants of Esau, Edom, and we read some of the comparisons between Esau, Edom, and this Babylon of Jeremiah 50 and 51. We ended last time with these comforting verses in Jeremiah 51, verse 25 and 26, and these should be especially comforting for those of us who know and understand somewhat the awesome power of this world system of Babylon over the minds and hearts of men. Jeremiah 51, verse 25 and 26, where God says, "Behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyeth all the earth, and I will stretch out mine hand upon thee, and roll thee down from the rocks, and will make thee a burnt mountain, and they shall not take of thee a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith the Lord." So, 2 wonderful promises for those who seek the end of unrighteousness upon the earth, and who seek God's righteousness in his kingdom. Number 1, God is against this Babylon, and number 2, God will destroy this Babylon utterly, totally. Nothing will be left when it's completed. Now, last time I compared this Babylon in Jeremiah with Esau, Edom in Obadiah, and I think I should continue that comparison to prove why I believe they are both the same prophetic entity. I'll list the similarities, and you can put your one finger in the prophet Obadiah and one in Jeremiah 50. I'll be reading back and forth. First of all, we've already seen that God is against Babylon. In Obadiah verses 3 and 4, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the cleft of the rock, whose inhabitant is high, that saith in his heart, Who shall bring thee down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." Same promise to Esau. We saw that Babylon's destruction would be total in verse 9 of Obadiah. "And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed to the end, that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter." In verse 18, the last part, "There shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it." We read several verses in Jeremiah where Babylon is charged with robbing God's people in Zion. Those who understand the present money and economic system which rules over us understand that robbery. In the 5th verse of Obadiah, God says to Edom, "If thieves come to thee, if robbers by night, would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes?" It's a rhetorical question, charging Esau with never ending his stealing. Verse 10, "For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever." Verse 13, "Thou shouldest not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity, yea, thou shouldest not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity." In other words, he's charging Esau with stealing the substance of Jacob. We read that Babylon was to be destroyed in Zion. In Jeremiah, in Obadiah 17, we read, "But upon Mount Zion shall be delivered, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions." In verse 21, "And Savior shall come up on Mount Zion to to judge them out of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord. They are both charged, both Babylon and Esau, Edom, with trying to mount up to the heavens. In Jeremiah 51, verse 53, though Babylon should mount up to heaven, and though she should fortify the house of her strength, yet from me shall spoilers come unto her, saith the Lord. In the fourth verse of Obadiah, about Esau, Edom, we read, though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, then shall I bring thee down, saith the Lord. Both Babylon and Edom are to be burned with fire. In Jeremiah 51, verse 25, behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyeth all the earth. I will stretch out mine hand upon thee, and roll thee down from the rocks, and will make thee a burnt mountain. And in verse 58, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the broad walls of Babylon shall be utterly broken, and her high gates shall be burned with fire, and the people shall labor in vain, and the folks in the fire, and they shall be weary. In Obadiah 18, speaking of the end of Edom, the house of Jacob shall be fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it. Now I read all of that because there is a theorem that you all learned in high school that things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. And the comparisons between this Babylon of Jeremiah and Esau, Edom are so numerous that they have to be the same identical entities spoken of in these two prophecies. This is also, as we've seen, the same Babylon of Revelation 17 and 18, which also will be destroyed by fire. All right, let's go on in Jeremiah 51. Verse 27, set ye up a standard in the land, blow the trumpet among the nations, prepare the nations against her, call together against her the kingdoms of Ararat, Mene, and Ashkenaz, appoint a captain against her, cause the horses to come up as the rough caterpillars, prepare against her the nations, with the kings of the Medes, the captains thereof, and all the rulers thereof, and all the land of his dominion. And the land shall tremble in sorrow, for every purpose of the land shall be performed against Babylon, to make the land of Babylon a desolation without an inhabitant. And some of you may have thought I missed something there when I read that the nations, or some of the nations, being prepared against this Babylon include Ashkenaz. Now, I have spent something in the nature of a half an hour to an hour already pointing out to you that it is the people called Jews today who are the guiders and directors of world communism, which we recognize as Red Babylon, and yet here we find the people called Ashkenaz going to come against and participate as nations fighting this Red Babylon. Now, I don't know how many people know this, but about 90% of all of the people who call themselves Jews call themselves Ashkenazim Jews. Out of curiosity, don't answer aloud, just answer my question, how many of you know that? How many of you know the term Ashkenazim? Well, most of you do. This is not generally known among the church-going people because they're about as ignorant of the Jews as of anything on the earth. But anyway, here is a book called The 13th Tribe, written by a Jew by the name of Arthur Kessler, and he says this, the Jews of our times fall into two main divisions, Sephardim and Ashkenazim. The Sephardim are descendants of the Jews who since antiquity have lived in Spain until they were expelled at the end of the 15th century and settled in the countries bordering on the Mediterranean, the Balkan, and to a lesser extent in Western Europe. They spoke a Spanish Hebrew dialect, Ladino, and preserved their own traditions and religious rites. In the 1960s, the number of Sephardim was estimated at 500,000. The Ashkenazim, at the same period, numbered about 11 million. Thus, in common parlance, Jew is practically synonymous with Ashkenazi Jew. But the term is misleading, for the Hebrew word Ashkenaz was, in medieval rabbinical literature, applied to Germany, thus contributing to the legend that modern Jewry originated on the Rhine. There is, however, no other term to refer to the non-Sephardic majority of contemporary Jewry. For the sake of sequentry, it should be mentioned that the Ashkenaz of the Bible refers to a people living somewhere in the vicinity of Mount Ararat and Armenia. Now, if you look back at Babylon here, in that verse 27, they're going to be raised the kingdoms of Ararat, Mene, and Ashkenaz. He said that these Ashkenaz lived in the vicinity of Mount Ararat. The name occurs in Genesis 10, verses 3, and 1 Chronicles 1, 6, as one of the sons of Gomer, who was a son of Japheth. Ashkenaz is also a brother of Togarmah and a nephew of Magog. And you'll recall that in Genesis 38 and 39, the great Antichrist power which will come against Israel is called Magog, whom the Khazars, according to King Joseph, claimed as their ancestor, and then he has another chapter on that. But worse was to come, for Ashkenaz is also named in Jeremiah 51:27, where the prophet calls his people and their allies to rise and destroy Babylon, calling upon the kingdoms of Ararat, Mene, and Ashkenaz, and then he spends quite a bit of time proving or telling us that these ancient Jews felt that the ancient caliphates were Babylon, and they, the Jews, were called upon to destroy it. And then he says this, later, some learned Khazar Jews who heard of Gaon's ingenious arguments called themselves Ashkenazim when they emigrated to Poland. So the Ashkenazim Jews are the people who come from Poland, Eastern Europe, or Western Asia, and generally today, among the Jews, when you say the word Ashkenazim, most of them, about 95% of them are, about 5% are Sephardim. In Israeli, it's probable that as many as 20% of those Jews are not Ashkenazim because of the Yemenite Jews, the Black Jews, Japanese Jews, and even dumb Gentiles who have married Jews and moved to Palestine. They're not Ashkenazim, of course. So here I said the modern Jews were the instigators and controllers of this Red World power, and here a force called Ararat and Ashkenaz is called against this Red World power. So we seem to have a dilemma. Well, first I want to establish, for those who are still skeptical, that it is true that the people we know as Jews today are the founders and controllers of world communism. This is a reprint from the May 1907 National Geographic magazine after the abortive communist revolution in Russia in 1905, but 10 years before the successful Bolshevik revolution in 1917. National Geographic, May 1907, quote, "Perhaps these reforms are the cause of the present tranquility because the revolutionary leaders nearly all belong to the Jewish race, and the most effective revolutionary agency is the Jewish Bund, which has its headquarters in Bialystok, where the massacre occurred last June. The government has suffered more from that race than from all of its other subjects combined. Whenever a desperate deed is committed, it is always done by a Jew, and there is scarcely one loyal member of that race in the entire empire. The great strike which paralyzed the empire and compelled the Tsar to grant a constitution and a parliament was ordered and managed by a Jew named Kristalev, president of the Working Men's Council, a young man only 30 years old. He was sent to the penitentiary for life and had not been behind bars more than 3 weeks when he organized and conducted a successful strike of the prison employees. Maxim, who organized and conducted the revolution in the Baltic provinces, is a Jew of marvelous ability. Last fall, he came over here lecturing and collecting money to carry on the revolutionary campaign, but for some reason has vanished and nobody seems to know what has become of him. Gershuman, the most resourceful leader of the terrorists, who was condemned to life imprisonment in the silver mines on the Mongolian frontier, has recently escaped in a water cask and is supposed to be in San Francisco. Now, I'm reading something from 1907. He is a Polish Jew, only 27 years old. I might enumerate 100 other revolutionary leaders, and every one of them would be a Jew. Wherever you read of an assassination or of the explosion of a bomb, you will notice in the newspaper dispatches that the man was a Jew. The most sensational and dramatic episode that has occurred since the mutiny was on October 27, when at the very center of St. Petersburg, at the entrance of Kazan Cathedral, four Jews held up a treasury wagon and captured $270,000. They passed the package to a woman who instantly vanished, and no trace of her was ever been found, but they were all arrested and were promptly punished. On the 8th of November, a few Jewish revolutionaries entered a treasury car near Radom in Poland. about $850,000 and disappeared. Every deed of that kind is done by Jews and the masters that have shocked the universe and occurred so frequently that the name pogrom was invented to describe them, were organized and managed by the exasperated police authorities in retaliation for crimes committed by Jewish revolutionists. Now, I might add that the Jews bought the National Geographic about 10 years later, and you'll never see any kind of information like that in the National Geographic since then. In fact, it has become a promoter of evolution, as you know. Another book was published in America shortly after the Revolution, titled Russian Bolshevik Revolution by an Edward Ross. And he writes, among other things, this is why refugees, obscure to us, although not to the Russians, who in exile had been obliged to work in our steel mills and tailor shops for a living, former residents of New York's East Side, which of course was the area where the Jews lived, will rise to be the head of the Soviets and later cabinet ministers of a government ruling a tenth of the human race. Ross wrote that book. He was in favor of the Jewish conquest of Russia. Here is a book written some years ago titled The Controversy of Zion by Douglas Reed. The book is about 550 pages. On page 417, quote, in 1920, official Bolshevik statement showed that 545 members of the chief ruling bodies included 447 Jews. In 1933, the American Jewish Journal Opinion stated that Jews occupied almost all important ambassadorial posts and that in White Russia, 61% of all officials were Jews. It also stated that the Jewish percentage of the population, then given as 158 million, was less than 2%. If this was true, it meant that Russia at that time contained less than 3 million Jews. In 1933, the Jewish Chronicle stated that one-third of the Jews in Russia had become officials. If this were the case, they plainly formed the new governing class. A little further, he tells about making a trip to the Soviet Union in 1935, and then he reports some of the things he saw. Now, I should explain. This man was a reporter for the London Times, and in 1935 he went to Russia accompanying Mr. Anthony Eden, who later became Prime Minister of England, as you know. He wrote of that time, quote, I was at once struck by something I had never met in any other country. My first report said that Mr. Eden drove from the station through streets lined with drab and silent crowds, and a Jewish censor demanded a scission of those words. At first I thought this merely satirist. I asked if he wished me to say that the song was composed of top-hatted bourgeoisie, but in following days I saw more, and in my book of 1938 I wrote, quote, the censorship department, he's speaking of Russia, the censorship department, and that means the whole machine for controlling the game and muzzling the foreign press, was entirely staffed by Jews. And this was a thing that puzzled me more than anything else in Moscow. There seemed not to be a single non-Jewish official in the whole outfit. I was told that the proportion of Jews in the government was small, but in this one department that I got to know intimately, they seemed to have a monopoly, and I asked myself, where were the Russians? The answer seemed to be that they were in the drab, silent crowds, which I had seen, but which must not be heard of. I soon learned from older hands that the proportion of Jews in the government was, in effect, not small, that they retained a large measure of control if they were not predominantly in control. I was unable to meet any Russians in Moscow. This was the other side of the same unique experience. I have never before held a ruling caste so completely segregated from the slave mass. Now, he was there as a reporter for a London newspaper with one of the officials from the British government, and because they met only officials, he said he never met any Russians, only Jews. At the time of this visit to Moscow, I had no cause to look for a predominance of Jews. The thing forced itself on my notice. I had hardly begun to think about the Jewish question in 1935. The impression I have recorded above was the first one of a trained observer who had never before seen Moscow or Russia. I find it confirmed by an equally experienced man who lived there for 12 years, from 1922 to 1934. Mr. William Henry Chamberlain's book remains today authoritative about that period. He wrote, quote, considerable number of Jews have made careers in the Soviet bureaucracy. Of perhaps a dozen officials whom I knew in the press department of the commissariat for foreign affairs, I recall only one who was not a Jew. Indeed, the predominance of Jews in this commissariat at the time of my stay in Russia was almost ludicrous. The Russians were mainly represented by the grizzled doorkeeper and the unkempt old woman who carried around tea. One also found many Jews in the GPO, or secret police, in the Communist International, and in departments connected with trade and finance. End of quote from this book, and of course he's quoting other people. So these men, as late as 1938, stated that practically every person who was in a place of rulership in the Soviet Union was a Jew. He says further, in 1937, the state of affairs, I believe, had not much changed. Mr. Solipine, whose father, the last of the persevering emancipators, had been assassinated in 1911, wrote that the substitution of Russians or others for Jews on the highest rung of the Soviet official ladder was patently a tactical move, and that the Jews, quote, still have in their hands the principal levers of control. The day they are obliged to give them up, the Marxist edifice will collapse like a house of cards. In other words, it was Jewry which became the power and held the power in all of Soviet Russia. He goes on to a great extent from other sources, and then he says, in communized Poland, the United States ambassador, Mr. Arthur Bliss Lane, saw and recorded the prevalence of Jews, many of them alien, in the key post of terrorism. Major Tufton Beamish, a member of the British Parliament, wrote, quote, many of the most powerful communists in Eastern Europe are Jews. I have been surprised and shocked to discover the large proportion of Jews to be found in the ranks of the secret police forces. And some of you may have read that Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whose huge book has been distributed in America, stated that at the time he left Russia, all commissars in charge of slave camps in Russia were Jews. This author goes on, to communize Hungary, the terrorist of 1919, Matthias Lakosi, born Roth in Yugoslavia, returned as premier in 1945, and on this occasion had the Red Army to keep him in that office. 8 years later, 1953, the Associated Press reported that, quote, 90% of the high officials in the Hungarian communist regime are Jews, including Premier Matthias Lakosi. End of that quote. The London Times in that year said Mr. Lakosi's cabinet was predominantly Jewish. Time magazine of New York spoke of, quote, the strong Jewish, 90% in the top echelon, government of communist Premier Matthias Lakosi, who is in himself a Jew. After the Hungarian Revolution, a Romanian newspaper, a copy I used to have and do not have anymore, stated that Khrushchev said the reason the Hungarian Revolution was successful was, quote, we allowed too many Jews in top positions in the Hungarian government, end of quote. In other words, the Hungarians finally came to an understanding that their rulers were Jewish. All they had to do was take captive the Jews, and they broke the Bolshevik power over their nation. And they did it in 10 days, until Russia, of course, then sent in Mongolian troops and put down the rebellion. And all of that information, except the last few remarks that I made, is from less than 10 pages in a 500-page book, The Controversy of Zion, by Douglas Reed. From the 1920s to the 1940s, Reed was a well-known reporter for the London Times when he began to write books such as this, exposing the Jewish power over communism. He lost his job. His book and others like these are literally banned in America by the book publishing and book distribution firms, which are almost exclusively in Jewish hands. And yet these are available from many conservative and patriotic sources, and even while they are available, and this evidence can be found to prove that the conquest of Russia and Eastern Europe and the torturing and killing of 100 million of our Christian brethren was carried out by Jews, we have men in America who claim to speak for God who tell us that we Christians must never resist or oppose the Jews or God will curse us. Some of you have heard this before. This is a classic, and yet it is very common in America. This is a news article written by and about Jerry Falwell. He says, quote, to stand against Israel is to stand against God. We believe that. I love the Jew because God loves the Jew. And as a follower of God, I'm under obligation to love as He loves. And my life is committed to a number of priorities, and one of them is to promote, protect, and to stand alongside the Jewish people, end of quote by Jerry Falwell. And as I read that and read other statements like that from other ministers, I am reminded of James 4 and verse 4, which we read in the class before church this morning. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. Now what we have ruling the world is a Jewish world government, both under communism and capitalism. So it is a Jewish world, and Jerry Falwell and the rest of these men have made themselves friends of that world by their statements and by their continual preaching. They have proven themselves to be nothing more nor less than wolves in sheep's clothing. They are the enemies of God Almighty. All right, all of this I read so far was written by a non-Jew. How about testimony from Jewish sources as to whether communism is a Jewish preacher? These are excerpts from many different sources. I'll just read a few. This is in The Communist, published in Kharkov, April 12, 1919, written by a Mr. Cohen. Quote, without exaggeration, it may be said that the great Russian social revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of the Jews. With the dark, oppressed masses of the Russian workmen and peasants have been able to throw off the yoke of the bourgeoisie by themselves? No. It was precisely the Jews who led the Russian proletariat to the dawn of the Internationale, and not only had led, but are also now leading the Soviet cause, which remains in their safe hands. We may be quiet as long as the chief command of the Red Army is in the hands of Comrade Leon Trotsky. And in my open letter about the Jews not being Israelites, I show that Leon Trotsky, of course, as some of you know, was a Jew. Here's a quote from the publication Communist, written by a Mr. Hermelin, who was a Jew, published in New York, 1917. Quote, the Russian Revolution was made by the Jews. We have created secret societies, planned the reign of terror. The revolution succeeded by our convincing propaganda and our mass assassinations in order to form a government truly ours. Here is an Angelo S. Rappaport, who was a Jew, in a book titled The Pioneers of the Russian Revolution, published in London in 1918. Quote, the Jews in Russia in their total mass were responsible for the revolution. Here's another publication by the Jewish Zionist titled The Maccabean, published in New York in 1965, under the title A Jewish Revolution. Quote, the revolution in Russia is a Jewish revolution, a crisis in Jewish history. It is a Jewish revolution because Russia is the home of about half the Jews of the world, and an overturning of this despotic government must have a very important influence on the destiny of millions living there and on the many thousands who have recently emigrated to the other countries. But the revolution in Russia is a Jewish revolution because Jews are the most active revolutionists in the Tsar's empire. And then, of course, there's pages and pages of that kind of information from Jewish sources. Now, I made the statement, communism is controlled by Jews. What about capitalists? This is a reprint of a document that is in the archives of our State Department. You can obtain a copy of it if you wish. Anyway, the chief document treating of the financing of the Russian Revolution is the one drawn up by the American Secret Service and transmitted by the French High Commissioner to his government. It was published by the Document Catholique of Paris in March of 1920 and preceded by the following remarks. And they took this article from the U.S. Secret Service and republished it. And then here is the article. And these are just sections. Section L. In February 1916, it was first discovered that a revolution was being fomented in Russia. It was found out that the following persons, as well as the banking houses mentioned, were engaged in this work of destruction. Jacob Schiff, Jew, Guggenheim, Jew, Max Breitung, Jew, Kuhn Loeb & Company, Jewish banking house, and these are all New York banking houses. of which the following are the directors: Jacob Schiff, Felix Warburg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Schiff, S.S. Hanauer, all Jews. There can be no doubt that the Russian Revolution, which broke out a year after the information given above had been received, was launched and fomented by distinctively Jewish influences. As a matter of fact, in April 1917, Jacob Schiff made a public declaration that it was thanks to his financial help that the Russian Revolution had succeeded. Another section. In the spring of 1917, Jacob Schiff began to supply funds to Trotsky to bring about the social revolution in Russia. The New York Daily Forward, which is a Judeo-Bolshevik organ, gave a subscription for the same purpose. Through Stockholm, the Jew Max Warburg was likewise furnishing funds to Trotsky. They were also in receipt of funds from the Westphalian Rhineland Syndicate, which is an important Jewish enterprise, as well as from another Jew, Olaf Ashberg, of the Nya Bankhan of Stockholm, and from Givotovsky, a Jew whose daughter is married to Trotsky. And then there is a list that you can see is about two columns long here of the people who own banks in New York, Stockholm, Berlin, in Paris, in Rome, and in the United States that gave money, millions upon millions of dollars, and sent it to Trotsky and the others to buy the Red Revolution in Russia. Now, I read all of that, and of course there is a lot more authoritative sources on this, and yet we have this dilemma here in verse 27 of Jeremiah 51, that the people who will be raised against this world system called Babylon here are the kingdoms of Ararat, Ninai, and Ashkenaz. At least two of those names are associated with the Jews. Well, let's read on. Prepare against her the nations of the kings of the Medes, the captains thereof, and all the rulers thereof, and all the land of his dominion. And the land shall tremble and sorrow, for every purpose of the Lord shall be performed against Babylon, to make the land of Babylon a desolation without inhabitants. The mighty men of Babylon have forborne to fight. They have remained in their folds. Their might hath failed. They became as women. They have burned her dwelling places. Her bars are broken. And here is the first clue of destruction of Babylon inside of Babylon. Notice what he says about the mighty men of Babylon. They have burned her dwelling places. To consider the possibility of what that would mean, they have burned her dwelling places, is it possible it means that the Bolsheviks, the communists themselves, will expose themselves. They'll burn down their own hiding places, as it were. Some of these articles which I read, by the way, are, I believe, accomplishing that, written by Jews claiming they are the world Bolsheviks. Okay, let's go on. Verse 31. One post shall run to meet another, and one messenger to meet another, to show the king of Babylon that his city is taken at one end, and that the passages are stopped, and the reeds they have burned with fire, and the men of war are affrighted. Notice, Babylon's army is so frightened they are helpless. At this time he's talking about. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor. It is time to thresh her, yet a little while, and the time of the harvest shall come. And I'll have to jump ahead, and then we'll go back and cover these verse by verse. Verse 39, in their heat I will make their feast, and I will make them drunken. In other words, God is going to do something with them that will make them lose control of their own system. He will make them drunken. Verse 57, and I will make drunk her princes and her wise men, her captains and her rulers and her mighty men. So God will take these rulers themselves, make them drunken. Turn to Obadiah, which we've already read most of, and we read the same thing. In verse 3 of Obadiah, he says, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. So something inside of them is going to trick them, fool them, lead them astray. Verse 6, how are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? Now, I read you for about 10 minutes there a few of those hidden things. I could have stood here for hours and hours and hours, read you from my own library the proof that the Jews are the Bolsheviks and communists of the world and also the world capitalists. So they're hidden things. These are even hidden things are going to be searched up. And in verse 7, all the men of thy confederacy, as be the men that are actually working with them, have brought thee even to the border, or almost to where they want to go. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. So it appears that both in Jeremiah of Babylon and in Obadiah of Esau Edom, we find that the major wound or destruction of Babylon and Esau will come from themselves. Will come from themselves. Verse 8 of Obadiah, shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? Now this is one of the things that frightens those of us who look at this world ruling system and see the power it has over the minds and hearts and politics and wealth of all the world, and we say, well, their power is so tremendous, there's nothing that can break it. And yet God says he will destroy their wise men and will destroy their understanding. They will not be able to carry on and control this power because they will lose their wisdom taken away by God. Perhaps you can see why it is possible that when God says that when he calls the kingdoms against Babylon, he'll actually call the kingdoms of Ararat and Ashkenaz, which are actually the kingdoms of the Jews, called against their own world system. Turn to Jeremiah 49, which we haven't read. I think I have proven that Esau Edom of Obadiah and Babylon of Jeremiah 1551 are the same thing. And most of you would understand they are a combination of Jewish capitalism and Jewish communism. Now here is another prophecy of the end of an entity called Esau Edom, just preceding the end of Babylon. Jeremiah 49, we'll begin in verse 7. Concerning Edom, thus saith the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman, as we had in Obadiah. He would destroy the wisdom of Teman, which is the son of one of the descendants of Edom. Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? God is asking Edom, have you lost your wit? Well, of course they will, because God said he would take it away from them. Now, again, notice the comparison here, and I'll have to just state these as we go along without reading the others. In verse 8, he says, flee ye, turn back, dwell deep, O inhabitants of Edom, for I will bring the calamity of Esau upon him, the time that I will visit him. If great gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some green grapes? If thieves by night, they will destroy the way have enough. And that is the same thing we read in Obadiah. But I have made Esau bare. I have uncovered his secret places. Yes, most of what I read during that 10 or 15 minutes is a secret. It's a mystery. It's totally hidden from our brethren out here in the world. You don't tell the average citizen on the street that Bolshevism is a Jewish invention and they hold quite true. They have been told entirely the opposite and they simply do not believe it. I have a letter in my files as an example of a lady who traveled back to Russia just a few years ago. She was born and raised in Russia, left there about 50 years ago. And she went back to visit relatives, and she wrote me a rather long letter, and she said that it was just like it was when she left, that every person who examined your luggage when you came to the airport, every person who signed your papers,
Every person who issued the money was a Jew. Every person in authority in the Soviet Union is a Jew. I had a good friend who I lived in Minnesota who had escaped from Latvia. And he made the remark to me, he said, if you ever meet a refugee from communism who denies that the Jews control communism, don't trust him. He lived in Latvia under the Bolsheviks. He said that Russia took over Latvia, that after they installed their commissars, every commissar was a Jew. And his wife and he both verified that after the German army came in and drove the Russians out, that the German army then took the Latvians into the jails in places where Latvians had been held in confinement, and they said the blood was 2 inches thick on the bottom of the jail cells, where they had killed and tortured Christians by the hundreds and put them to death. Who did? Jews, the same people that this Falwell says he is on the side of the Jewish people. Now, this is a secret. This is hidden from most people in the world today, and yet God says when he was going to lay Esau bare, I have uncovered his secret places, and he shall not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, and his brethren, and his neighbors, and he is not. Leave the fatherless children, I will preserve them alive, and let thy widows trust in me. For thus saith the Lord, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. And art thou he that shall altogether go unpunished? Thou shalt not go unpunished, but thou shalt surely drink of it. And if you want to study what that is, you can read the references in the scripture to the cup of trembling. Verse 13, for I have sworn by myself, saith the Lord, that Bozrah shall become a desolation, a reproach, a waste, and a curse, and all the cities thereof shall be perpetual waste. That's what we read in Jeremiah 50 of Babylon. I'm sorry to end on that point, but God willing will consider and will see that the Bible, these prophecies all fit, they all make sense, and they all fit what to most of the world is a mystery. The mystery we call world communism, Bolshevism, capitalism, whatever you wish to call it, that it is in the hands of a people identified here in the Bible as being anti-Christ and anti-Christian, the people today who are hidden behind a veil of error and false teaching, as if they were not the enemies of God, but were actually God's chosen people. But they will be revealed, and the hidden things of Esau put out through the Bible, through God's word, will be exposed. Well, let us stand. O Father, the God of Israel, we thank you for the promise given by word that unrighteous